series.
Peace be with you. Well, Dave, thanks for all the announcements there. And then also, you should be in prayer for Dave. Dave and Bradley Wuthrich, they are Purdue graduates. And Purdue has made it to the finals in the NCAA tournament, but they are facing a daunting foe. So they might be, well, last year was worse. They lost in the first round. So we need to rub that in. Okay. All right. This is, we're in a series in the Gospel of Matthew. And this is technically part 42 of that series. But what we're actually going to do is we're going to take a little bit of time and kind of do it's sort of a mini series. It's probably going to be three Sundays, where we're going to pause or at least turn our lens to try to focus on something that I think Jesus is putting in front of us. And so if you have your Bibles open and you turn to Matthew chapter 8, what you will see is that in Matthew chapter 8 and Matthew chapter 9, those two chapters are packed with nine miracles. And a couple Sundays ago, before Easter, before Palm Sunday, so back on March 17th, I think, we looked at the first three miracles in chapter 8. But if you were to look through both chapters, you would see that there's just a bunch of miracles, nine of them. And they present Jesus with this incredible amount of mercy and his love for people and his care for people, people that are sick, people that are scared, people that are in trouble. Like Jesus coming alongside and just having a heart for the other, having a welcoming, hospitable, generous spirit towards other people. He has a heart of kindness towards those who are hurting. This would be a beautiful picture of the mercy of Jesus and how the followers of Jesus are invited to reflect that mercy to the world, to be good lovers of people. But Matthew does something really significant in the midst of all this. So we have these nine miracles, but in the midst of them, there's actually three miracles. And then something happens, and then three more miracles, and then something happens, and then three more miracles. And you say, well, what is it that happens? What happens is that Matthew places, after the third miracle and then after the sixth miracle, he places two poignant statements about Jesus' expectations for his followers. Matthew seems to be showing us that as important as the miracles of Jesus are, the most fundamental component of Jesus' ministry is to call people to follow him. And so as he's putting on display his love for people, his care for their troubles, his awareness of their hurts, this incredible, merciful heart to the hardships of navigating this world, Matthew wants us to be reminded that Jesus, that is a beautiful aspect of Jesus' life, but in some ways, it's a byproduct. It's an outcome of something even more fundamental. And that thing that's more fundamental is this reality of giving yourself to Jesus. Jesus wants us to care about others, but that is meant to be a byproduct or the overflow of this all-in following of Jesus Christ. Jesus thinks you should give your whole life to him, your whole life to this movement of his. So over these next few weeks, we're going to take a look at these two calls in Matthew chapter 8, verses 18 through 22, and in Matthew 9, verses 9 through 13. And we're going to try to look at the priorities of following Jesus. We're going to look at some of the practices of following Jesus. And then we're going to look at the politics of following Jesus. So I invite you to try to be here throughout that these next 3 weeks. So as you look at Matthew chapter 8, in the text that was just read by Glenn, I want you to see that in verse 18, what Matthew does, he says that there's this, the crowds. He says, now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. Now, if you've been around Sojourn for a long time, or maybe there's just an opportunity that you've had to wrestle or consider these things, or maybe it's never crossed your mind ever in your life. But the way that the Gospels interact with the term crowd or crowds is not usually very positive. In Mark's Gospel specifically, Mark is usually contrasting the crowds with like commitment. And so it's like the crowds are kind of this undefined mob of people. And it's like Mark contrasts that with the committed followers. And so if he refers to the crowd, it's not usually a compliment. And Matthew is a little bit less overt, but the Gospels in general treat the crowds this way. It's kind of almost they treat the crowd with a little bit of a skeptical manner. It's almost like, okay, there's a big horde of people here, but what does that mean? And we've all probably been part of something like that. That there's been a whole lot of people that have been invested in it or interested in it or present. But what does that mean? Like, not everything that grows big is good. And the Gospels have a little bit of a skeptical eye towards the crowd. And so here in Matthew chapter 8, verse 18, what we see Jesus do, he sees a crowd around him and he says, let's go over there. So it's like, I don't know about these guys. Like, I mean, actually Jesus did know about these guys, but if you just, you know, it's like, oh, what's going on here? And it's like, let's go over to the other side. And so that's what happens in verse 18. Apparently it looks like maybe after they went to the other side, but it might've been before they left, a scribe comes up to Jesus and says to him, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. I will follow you wherever you go. Now, if what I just said about the crowds is true, that there's this sense in which the crowd can kind of be this group, this throng of people, and what Jesus' message is actually, if you're going to follow me, it takes intentionality. It takes action. And so if you're just in the crowd, and I'm saying for you today, if you're just in the crowd, if your engagement with Jesus is just because maybe you're related to somebody else who's into Jesus, and you're just kind of here this morning, or you're just kind of in the orbit of spiritual things because somebody else has kind of drug you into that orbit, if that's where you're at, the message of Jesus is it actually takes initiative. It takes some action on your part. It's not good enough to have just been raised up in it or to have grown up around church or to have a spouse who loves Jesus or to have kids that want to go to church or to accompany your parent to church. Jesus is saying it's not good enough to just be in the crowd. Like that's not Jesus' design. It takes action. It takes intentionality. And then you have this guy show up and be like, I'm with you. I will follow you wherever you go. So I want to refer to this guy as Mr. Hasty. All right? Mr. Hasty. And as you think about Mr. Hasty, and then you see how Jesus responds to him, he responds with a kind of cryptic statement. It's not a, wow, this is great. Jesus almost pushes the brakes on Mr. Hasty. Now, if you were to read multiple commentaries and kind of get the sense of what do people think is the problem with Mr. Hasty, because it seems good. He says, Jesus, I'll follow you wherever you will go. Why wouldn't Jesus just be like, all right, let's go. That's it. Thumbs up to you. That's not how Jesus responds. So what is the problem with Mr. Hasty? Well, some think that the problem is recklessness. And this certainly could be the case. Notice that he says, I will follow you wherever you go. So I don't care where, I will follow you wherever you will go. Jesus hears this and says, you don't know what you're saying. That might make sense to say that to you in your head. It might, but you don't know what you're saying. This reminds me a little bit of Luke 14. And in Luke 14, we read about this banquet. You read about banquet, but then after the banquet, you find out that there's this person that puts together a party, and I'm getting my parables mixed up. It's not the party. It's a guy who's he's going to build a tower, and Jesus looks and says, "Who would ever build a tower without coming up with the budget first? You don't start building a tower without figuring out how much the tower is going to be. That's reckless. That's overcommitting. That's not actually counting the cost." He uses another illustration. He says, what king goes to war against another army without pausing and first figuring out how big is their army? Can we stack up against their army? It would be reckless to do that. And so in Luke 14, Jesus gives this picture, this snapshot of saying, you don't build a tower without running a budget. You don't go to war without counting the soldiers. Like, you got to think things through. You got to evaluate what your commitments are going to be. And it seems like that might be what Jesus is saying to Mr. Hasty. It's like, you don't know what you're saying. You have not counted the cost. Some others think that the problem with Mr. Hasty is arrogance. Well, this could be too. Because if you notice, he says, I will follow you wherever you go. And it seems like he might be saying, Jesus, this is your lucky day. I am a scribe. I am trained in the law. I am smart. I graduated from the right kind of school. You have finally landed a legitimate convert. And our movement can now have credibility. Credibility with the right people. Credibility with the movers and the shakers. And if you've ever been part of anything, if you've had a small little company or you've been in charge of any sort of a movement, you recognize the temptation of this. You recognize the temptation of like, you know, my wife and I have a little candle company, and it's just like, you know, could you imagine, you know, Paris Hilton, who comes to Traverse City sometimes, like posting a picture on Instagram with our candle? You'd be like, we've hit it. This is what we've waited for, the moment that Paris Hilton cares about our candles. It seems like this guy is coming to Jesus and being like, I'm that kind of guy. I'm the kind of guy that moves the needle. I'm the kind of guy that you want. You're dealing with these uneducated fishermen. They just got the bare minimum. They just got the, you know, year 0 through 12. I have gone through all of the training. I've gone to the best schools. I've got the best resources. And I am now on your team. I am in. And this teacher, you know, the education piece seems to be big. He looks at Jesus and refers to Jesus as teacher. So there's some level of respect for the stuff that Jesus is saying. So maybe this is Jesus's lucky day. Maybe this is. Maybe this, you know, Jesus could get his foot in the door with the important people. Well, whether it's recklessness or arrogance, regardless of what his problem was, whether it's one or both of those, Jesus responds with this ambiguous, cryptic statement. And what he says to him, you can find it there in verse 20. He says, foxes have holes and birds have the air of the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And he calls himself the Son of Man. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man 30 times. And so Matthew loves to record this title, but every time he records it, it's Jesus calling himself the Son of Man. Now you can look into that, and that term is like pregnant with a lot of ideas. But one of the ideas that it brings to the table is a level of mystery, that Jesus is referring to himself as Son of Man. Now there's some Old Testament connections, there's some salvific connections, but there's also some mysterious connections. Like, what does Jesus mean by that exactly? But he says, foxes have holes, birds of the air, they have nests, but I have nowhere to lay my head. It's like Jesus wants Mr. Hasty to slow down and think about what he's saying. It's like Jesus is saying to him, do you know what you are asking to join up with? Do you know the life that you're actually trying to say yes to? You know, Bible scholar Dale Bruner points out that the Hebrew reveals a little play on words, and it actually shows up in our English pretty well. Did you notice that the scribe says, I will follow you wherever? And Jesus responds by saying, I have nowhere to lay my head. The scribe says, anywhere. And Jesus says, there's nowhere. That's not what's happening here. There's not that kind of security. This word where, Jesus responds by saying, no, you don't understand. I don't have an earthly place. I don't have earthly possessions. I don't have an earthly home. Like that, Jesus takes his word and actually just negates it and says, nowhere. That's not on the table. It's not the movement that I'm about. I'm not trying to gain this odd market share in some way of like trying to outpace the competition. I'm going at something completely different. I'm offering something completely different. This is not an add-on. This is your whole life. Do you understand the stuff that I'm talking about? Following Jesus is not about security or status in this life. Jesus is literally saying, I'm not going to give you that, not in this life. That's not what it's about. I have nowhere. You'll follow me anywhere? I have nowhere. Jesus is saying that his life is one of sacrifice, and that following him is not a side gig. Following Jesus does not lead to a life of ease. Now, does that sound confusing? Does that sound confounding? I think it probably should. It should cause most, if not every one of us in this room, to squirm in our seats a little bit. Look at where we live. Look at the resources we each individually have. Do we appear to be the kinds of people that have given up security to follow Jesus? Have you and I actually committed to follow Jesus? Would Jesus look at us and say, Mr. Hasty, Mrs. Hasty, hang on. You're saying things with your mouth, but do you know what you're signing up for? Do you know what following me looks like? Well, this short interaction with Mr. Hasty is paired with another short interaction in the next couple verses. So you walk away from this interaction, you're like, okay, yeah, good. Okay, caution, it's important to be cautious. It's important to be thoughtful, to be thorough. That's true. But watch out, because there's another ditch. We love to deceive ourselves. Maybe you're someone in here who's like, that's right, Mr. Hasty. You should check things out. You should double check. You should have better, you know, notes. You should be running the budget. You should be thinking this through more. Okay, caution is good, but meet Mr. Hesitant. In verses 21 and 22, we run into another person. It says, another of the disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. Let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus responds to him with brashness. He says, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. That is pretty harsh language. Now some people think, like, you know, what's wrong? Why did Jesus respond like this? Some think that Mr. Hesitant's problem was that he was a procrastinator. It was procrastination. Well, that could be. If you notice, he says, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. There is nothing in his comments that suggests his father has already died, or even that his father was in his final days. He could have just been using this as an excuse. And this was a very legitimate Jewish culture issue. I'll talk about that more in a second here. But he might be using it as an excuse to dodge full commitment to Jesus. This reminds me of the other passage in Luke 14 that I was trying to reference a minute ago. The banquet, where there's a guy who puts a banquet together and he sends out all of these invites to all of these people. And he says, hey, I'm going to have this big banquet. And this is no joke. You know, food and especially meat was a luxury at this point in time. And this guy sends out these invitations and says, come and feast with me. So it comes time for the feast. And he says to his servant, hey, go get all the people. Go get all the invitees. Go get all the guests and tell them the food's hot. Like, don't delay. Come on in. Let's go. And the servant goes to all the people that were invited. And if you read in Luke 14, he goes to them and they all have the stupidest excuses. They're so dumb. They say, I bought a field, but I've never seen it. I can't come to the party. Somebody else is like, I bought a bunch of oxen and I've never seen them. I can't come to the party. Another person's just like, I got married. I can't come to the party. And it's like, The person who put the feast on, put the banquet on, the servant comes back, he says, none of them are coming. He's like, you know what? Forget that. Go out into the byways and the highways and you find anybody because this feast is worth having. Get anybody in here. And in that parable, there's this picture of pathetic excuses. Jesus tells this parable to say the banquet has been set and you've been invited, and people come up with the craziest excuses to not listen to Jesus, to not receive the invitation, to not receive the welcome. And it seems like maybe procrastination is part of this. He's saying, oh, I don't know if I can commit to this. I don't really want to commit to this. Let me come up with an excuse. My dad, I need to be there to bury him. Culturally speaking, this was extremely important. It was like, you know, maybe you're familiar with some of the Eastern nations and in China specifically, but the way that they honor the dead and being present for the burial of your loved ones is a significant cultural moment. So this is, it's a completely legitimate thing. But we don't even know if his dad was near death. We don't know any of those details at all. It could have just been like, I don't want to go too far because you never know. See, it procrastination. Some other commentators think that Mr. Hesitant's problem was priorities, that he was committed to his earthly father more than he was to Jesus. This could also be true. If you notice that he says, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And again, there's a little bit more going on culturally here than our modern Western eyes might see. N.T. Wright talks about the fact that the Shema, hear, O Israel, was the most important prayer that any Israelite would ever pray. But in their writings, they actually say that there is something that comes in front of praying that prayer, and it would be the burial of a parent. So as important as the Shema is, as important as the prayer, hear, O Israel, is, the death of a parent and dealing with the death of a parent actually trumps this most significant prayer. So when he asks Jesus, can I go bury my dad? Every Jew that was listening would have been like, they would have expected Jesus to say, oh my, yes, for sure. You must go do that. And then you can come follow me. You go do that. That's so important. And then come follow me after. But that is not what Jesus does at all. N.T. Wright says that what Jesus does here is one of the most shocking things in the whole story of the gospel. He tells this man, let the dead bury their dead. You must follow me right now. This is a part, N.T. Wright, this is what he writes. What Jesus was doing was so important, so urgent, so immediate, that it was the one thing that mattered. Whatever else you were thinking of doing, this comes first. It is possible that this man's father had died. It is possible that his father was near death. But it's also possible that he was using his dad to keep his options open. They didn't want to go all in with Jesus. So like those invited to the banquet, he produced an excuse to not follow Jesus. And Jesus looks at him and says, it'll never work like that. It'll just never work like that. The only way this works is if Jesus has first place. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his most famous book, The Cost of Discipleship, maybe the most famous quote from that book, he says, when Christ bids a man come, he bids him come and die. To come and die to himself, to come and die to herself, to come and die to their agenda. And why does Jesus demand that? Because Jesus says in another gospel in Luke 9, that if you try to save your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for Jesus, then he'll bring you to the real life, the life you've always longed for. So what about you? What is keeping you from going all in with Jesus? What is keeping you from just giving up and actually trusting Jesus as the Lord and Master of your life? There are so many excuses that are possible, aren't there? My guess is that you can think of many, but I don't really care how long of a list you can make. What I really care about is what is the excuse that I'm leaning on? What is the excuse that's actually controlling my decisions? What is the thing that I have become convinced of is bigger and more important than giving everything to Jesus? This guy has one that the culture would look at and say, oh, of course that one comes first. Of course you need to go do that with your dad. But what is it that we look at and say, oh, of course that comes first? Maybe it's some sort of a need to not judge another person's lifestyle. Maybe it's a need to acquire a certain amount of money for retirement. Maybe it's the use of your time and a sense of need for self-care and making sure that you have enough margin for you. You know, the list is long of things that our culture would look at and be like, For sure. For sure you have to do those things first. And then you can follow Jesus after that. And Jesus looks at this man and says, it will never work like that. So whether it's Mr. Hasty's recklessness and arrogance, or whether it's Mr. Hesitant's procrastination and priorities, or anything else that's getting in the way, Jesus is calling all of it out. Listen, Jesus doesn't demand that you get rid of everything, but he demands that you see it for what it is, that it gets dethroned. What one of the church fathers named Augustine, this is kind of his big idea. His big idea was that what Jesus wants to do is order your loves. He wants to get the order of your loves reorganized. He wants Jesus Christ to be at the top, and then guess what? It orders all of your other loves, and it makes you better at loving all of those people. And so if you are a person who is married and your spouse is the top of your loves, they are on the throne of your heart, and you live your life for your spouse and you do everything you can to keep them happy and to make sure that they're having their best life now, and they're your ultimate love, and you come to Jesus, that means that your marriage just got dethroned. It just got demoted. But with Jesus Christ as the ultimate on the throne of your heart, it will actually make you a better spouse. Good news. Because you can now love your spouse for their sake. You can actually love your spouse in light of what Jesus says is good for the world. You can bring things to bear that are hard to talk about, that you don't want to talk about, but you're not threatening your ultimate love, your love of Jesus. It'll make you a better parent. It'll make you a better coworker. It'll make you a better friend. And Jesus says that that's what's got to happen. There's got to be a reordering of your loves. And until Jesus is the ultimate love of your heart, until he's on the throne of your heart, it's not going to work out. You know, Psalm 33 is a psalm that I've read maybe to some of you quite a few times. But when we're facing hard things or difficult challenges, and it's like it feels like maybe everything's slipping away. So Psalm 33, this is what the psalmist says. The king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might, it cannot rescue. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. You're not supposed to live through famine. And yet the psalmist says, guess what? A king with all of those army, with all of those warriors, with all that big army, it's not going to work out. What about the warrior who has all of that strength? On the last day, it's not going to work out. What about the person who has a war horse? What an advantage in the battle. The psalmist says, in the end, it's not going to do what you need it to do. None of those things are going to stand when you most need them to stand. Big armies, big muscles, big resources, anything you could list. It's not going to pan out on the last day, but the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. What he's saying is the moment that everything should fall apart, it doesn't. On the day when you need it most, that's when you're going to find out that Jesus is all you need. And you'll never know that Jesus is all you need until Jesus is all you have. He wants me and he wants you to be all in with him. So Mr. Hasty, Mr. Hesitant, listen, I want you to hear this. Jesus has an agenda for your life. And I hope that Sojourn persistently, lovingly calls all of us to that agenda. You know, there's a church in Portland, and this is the way that they say it. This church is speaking. We have an agenda for your life, and we want to be really clear about it. We want to increasingly radicalize you to discipleship to Jesus. So if you're not into following Jesus, or you're not interested in trying to seriously follow Jesus with everything you've got, then we want you to hear two things. First, you are so welcome here. We love having you here, and we're so glad you're here. But second, we need you to know that eventually this place will become uncomfortable for you unless you decide to seriously follow Jesus. Listen, that kind of an idea has been prayed over this church so many times over the last 15 years. The language that we use as our mission statement is that we want to help people follow Jesus. But maybe you've heard this language. We want this to be a place to call home and a place of disruption. We love the family dynamics at play in our church. But if this place is just a place that feels like home, if it's just a couch, if it just feels comfortable, then we are probably not being faithful to the word, to the message of Jesus. We want it to be a place that feels like home, and we want it to be a place of disruption. We want you to experience formation, but we also recognize that our hearts need deformation. That we have all kinds of structures and idols that have grown up into our hearts, maybe even just over the last 7 days, that we need to have torn down. So it's not just formation, it's deformation. We need all of the gunk and all of the false gospels to be torn out of our hearts. And I love this language that we want to be honest with you. We want to radicalize you to discipleship to Jesus. And if you're not into that, man, we are so glad you're here, but we want the architecture of this place to be uncomfortable if you're not committed to Jesus. We want this to be a room full of people who are committed to following Jesus, that it shapes our life. It changes the way we do what we do. It changes our priorities and the way we use our resources. That we actually look in the mirror and we say, God, I recognize that I need you to shape me. Would you do that? God, would you use the people in my life to help me see my blind spots? This is not a solo project. We recognize that the Bible steps on our toes. We want to be aware of that, and we want to be aware of the fact that that can be really tender, it can really hurt. But instead of running away, we want to try to follow it and do it together. You might say, why? Well, because Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Because what Jesus offers to us is the way, he offers us the truth, and he offers us ultimate life. You know, some of us saw a video recently by a seminary professor named Dr. Rob Plummer, and he used this little analogy, and he said, if you could go back to the 1990s, and you had the opportunity to invest in Apple stock or in Amazon stock, how much of your money would you invest in those stocks? The answer is obvious. You'd invest everything you got. Dr. Plummer says, what the Bible is telling us is that there's a day coming when we're going to look in the rearview mirror and we're going to say, oh, man, we should have gone all in. We should have gone all in on the kingdom. That's where it's at. That's where the returns were. That was the valuable thing. That was the most essential thing. And Jesus is too kind to present a gospel that does not also say you've got to give up your agenda. You've got to give up your plans. Hastiness and hesitancy are both, they're actually understandable, but we want to turn from both of them and give our whole lives to Jesus. Now you might be thinking, I could never do that. Well, guess what? There are good reasons to conclude that both Mr. Hasty and Mr. Hesitant end up as disciples of Jesus. That they both actually end up as fully devoted followers of Jesus. Did you notice the little phrase at the beginning of verse 21? Another of the disciples? Matthew wrote this down not in real time. He wrote this down decades afterwards. It's like Matthew's looking back there and being like, remember when that guy showed up and he was like so hasty? He was so cocky. I mean, he ended up being all in with Jesus. He became a disciple. And then he says, and another one of Jesus' disciples, the way he interacted was with hesitancy. And he came to Jesus being like, I don't think I'm ready. And Jesus is like, get on the boat, man, let's go. And he did it. Matthew's referring to both of these individuals as disciples, as people who, look, when Jesus critiqued them, it may have hurt. When the first guy says, I'll follow you anywhere, and Jesus says, there is nowhere. That's not in the cards. That may have hurt his feelings, but it appears that he listened. And instead of running away offended, he leaned into the message of Jesus. And when Mr. Hesitant was like, I'm not sure, I think I got something to do back there. And Jesus is like, no, follow me now. Apparently he did. Apparently he was like, I can't believe you just said that. And then instead of running away, he drew near to Jesus. And man, my prayer for you today is that if any of this is offensive to you, if you have things in your life you're like, no, I think that is more important than Jesus. Listen, Jesus disagrees with you, but I hope that instead of running away from him, you run towards him and you're at least willing to listen more. You're at least willing to sit in and say, who is this Jesus? Who is it that would actually dare to say this? That would disagree with me, that would disagree with the culture, someone that loves me enough to correct me. I don't know about you, but it seems to me that we live in a culture where nobody really wants to disagree with you. That whatever you think about your life is fine. Whatever your truth is fine. Whatever your identity is fine. However you view the world is fine. Jesus is not going to do that. Jesus is going to come to us and he's going to confront us in love because he is the way, the truth, and the life. So what is Jesus' critique of your life that you need to hear? It might be really offensive. Like Mr. Hasty, Jesus calls us to whole life discipleship. Count the cost. And like Mr. Hesitant, Jesus recalls us. You know, it's very possible that Mr. Hesitant was a disciple who was getting sideways. He had committed to Jesus, and now he's starting to be like, you know, I think I got to go back home for a bit. And Jesus is recalling. And whether that's the case with Mr. Hesitant or not, I can tell you from personal experience that that's my life. That Jesus has to recall me time and time again. That Jesus has to get inside of my life and blow it up from the inside out and say to me, Matt, your priorities aren't what they should be. Matt, you're getting sideways. Matt, am I first or do you have another first? John Calvin said that our hearts are idol factories. If that's true, then we have to become professional idol smashers. Because our hearts are always producing new idols. That means on a daily, regular basis, I've got to be like, what's trying to get on the throne? What has gotten on the throne? My reputation, comfort, money, approval, success. And be willing, by God's grace, to smash the idol again. Boy, this is the good news of the gospel, though. Jesus came to rescue us because he knows we couldn't rescue ourselves. That this is what he came to do. He didn't come say, here, go do this and save yourself. He came to save us and then invite us into this kind of a life. It's the good life. And he saves us into it. As I mentioned earlier, this call to follow Jesus is surrounded by healings. Do you see if we tried to put all this together? Jesus is showing us that he has the authority to heal not just physical sickness, but all the sickness and brokenness and sin of the whole world. And he is the only one who can take all of that sickness and sin and all of that pain onto himself and out of this world. But you have to trust him with your life. You have to give up your agenda, your self-salvation projects. It costs everything, but it's the best investment you will ever make. You know, Jesus helped the poor, but he was not crucified for that. Jesus fed the hungry, but he was not crucified for that. Jesus was crucified for preaching that he was the true king that all people should follow, that they should all bow to. It was a scandal then, and it is a scandal now. But it's true. All you have to do is give up your life And Jesus will give you the life your soul has been longing for, whether you knew it or not. Can I tell you one way that we experience this kind of disruption, the disruption of Jesus every single Sunday? It's with the Lord's table. When we come to this point in our service, we are all faced with a question. And the question that we are faced with most fundamentally is the reality of this table. Is this for me? This body that has been broken and this blood that has been shed, have I put my hope and trust in that? Is this meal the hope of my life? Is this Christ the one that I'm trusting to save me? And if your answer to that question is yes, I have transferred my trust from myself to Christ, then this table is wide open and we invite you, we implore you to come and eat and drink. But if that's not what you've done, then many Sundays we say to you, instead of coming and getting the bread and the cup, stay where you are and receive Christ. Recognize that he is the ultimate one that you most need. And so every Sunday, whether you're realizing it or not, this is a point of decision. This is a point of disruption. The door is so wide open. The love of God poured out in Christ for you is so unspeakable. But you are confronted with a choice. Have you transferred trust from you to the only one who can save? If our servers will please come, let's pray. God, thank you so much for loving us enough to say really hard things to us. I just think of how tempting it would be for a normal person to have someone else show up and be like, I'll follow you anywhere you will go. And to just be like, all right, let's go, let's do that. But Jesus' love and his kindness, it's too rich, it's too deep. God, I thank you that Jesus still meets us like that, that he still wants to open our eyes and open our ears. He still wants to call us and to recall us, to remind us of our first love, to remind us of priorities that maybe have gotten sideways, to invite us in to a life with him for the very first time. God, I pray that you would do that work right now, that the disruption and the friction that maybe we need to feel, God, that we would feel it, that if this is stepping on our toes, that instead of running from it, God, we would lean in and actually maybe believe that you really do love us enough to raise these kinds of questions and these kinds of concerns. God, we believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. We believe that he's worth giving our whole lives to. Would you help us see how? In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.